Yes. Okay, good morning. Now let's have a look at another major structure of the international avant-garde built in Moscow, a building which is, by the way, together with Ginsberg, Nahum Fein, discussed later, on the same boulevard. So we're talking of a very particular place in Moscow where you find three significant buildings. In 1928, and I'll try to read my paper in order to save time. In 1928, an unprecedented event took place in Moscow. The architects, facing each other in the competition for the design of the headquarters of the cooperative movement, or Centro Soyuz, requested that the job be given to Le Corbusier. Unprecedented. You don't see today architects backing away from a competition and say, "Give the job to this guy, he's much better." Never. Okay. Le Corbusier was then present for the first of his three trips to Moscow, three trips he made in 28, 29, and 30. Designed with his partner and cousin Pierre Jeanneret, with the collaboration of the Russian architect Nikolai Kolli, the building was completed in 1936, not without a troubled genesis. These photos are not by Richard Perle. They are my own one, as most of the photos in this presentation, not all of them. The initial patron was Isidor Lyubimov, an old Bolshevik who knew quite well the policies of Western cities and was an ambitious leader. The building was meant to accommodate the offices of the cooperatives, then thriving, as the new economic policy was giving way to the five-year plan. A large auditorium for management meetings and spectacles had to be included. The site chosen was located on the Myasnitskaya Street on the left, seen in a photo published by Mendelssohn, an important radial street close to the Gasthorg office building, which you see here, built by Boris Velikovsky in 1927. Le Corbusier's project, as shown on the cover of the magazine The Construction of Moscow, survived the first round of the competition, to which Peter Behrens on the left top and Max Stout, left bottom, had also taken part. He was invited to a second round together with Soviet architects, including Ivan Leonidov, whose project, extraordinary abstract project you see on the right, which was never judged as the competitors joined voice to support his entry. But Leonidov worked with Le Corbusier and helped him establish his final project. Le Corbusier worked hard to imagine a series of solutions for the articulations of the office wings and the auditorium before coming to Moscow in October 28 with the first complete set of drawings. As he frequently did to outbid the commissions he was received, Le Corbusier went far beyond the limits of the plot on the top, proposing a complete reorganization of the neighborhood. But the project was in itself a clear design, one main and thicker wing alongside the Myasnitskaya, as you see it here. This is the project with which he came to Moscow in 28. One main and thicker wing along the Myasnitskaya, two thinner lateral wing, and the auditorium in the back connected to a fourth wing leading to a new street to be opened according to the city plan of 1928. Following his discovery of the crowds invading the streets of Moscow at that time, he modified the building to introduce pilotis under each wing, changing the main axis of the auditorium. He changed this axis here and suppressed the fourth wing. He wrote in a text published in Précision in 1930, "Circulation is a term which I used all the time in Moscow, so much so, in fact, that some Soviet delegates became distinctly ill at ease. Architecture is circulation. Think what this means. It condemns academic methods and sanctions the principle of pilotis. From the pilotis, which you see here, the employees of the Centro Soyuz were supposed to reach their workspace using a system of ramps, climbing ramps going seven floors up and some elevators." In Précision, Le Corbusier also insisted on the upper tier of the building, on the skyline, he writes. "The impeccable lines of this crystal crystal prism circled with a band of volcanic stone that marked the parapet of the terraces. The sharp break with the sky is one of the most, we might see it from this previous slide, is one of the most adorable conquests of modern techniques, the elimination of the roof and the cornice. Between the sky and the pilotis, Le Corbusier used different types of facades, some clad in Caucasus stuff and others in glass, using the concept of the neutralizing wall he was then imagining, in combination with the principle of what he called exact respiration inside the rooms. This very early air conditioning scheme proved much too costly to implement in Russia and was a failure when implemented at the Salvation Army in Paris, because no extraction of the soiled air was provided. Besides returning to a more conventional heating system, the project approved for construction embodied certain changes in respect to the model exhibited on the left at the Museum of Contemporary Western Art in Moscow, the main one being an opening up of the plan toward the West. Construction had started that year, Korb in Moscow, 1930, never returned. But Le Corbusier would never see the building again. The supervision of the site was carried out by Colli, Nicolai Colli. You see him with Yvonne, Le Corbusier's wife, and Pierre Jeanneret drinking Bordeaux in Paris. Colli supervised the site in contact with Paris by mail and helped by former draftsman from the office, the Czech František Šámr, who had moved to Moscow. Yet the scarcity of building materials led to an interruption of the works in 1931 and 32. Former Bauhaus director Hannes Meyer couldn't hide his schadenfreude, writing, I quote, "This orgy of concrete and glass will never be finished and will be abandoned if only because of the materials," end quote. Construction resumed in 1932, when Lyubimov was appointed People's Commissar for Light Industry. He would later be killed in the 1937 purges. The new function of the building did not really impact its architecture. It was always offices, 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 and a large meeting room. And the reports to Le Corbusier by visitors like José Luis Sert or Charlotte Perriand, who both came to Moscow in 1934, were rather positive. Here we see stages in the design, a section on top with, we see a section how the ramp works, and we see in pencil the profile of the ramp and the office floors, and here a typical view of the offices with the production curves of the 5 years plan and the kind of atmosphere which would have been created by the glass wall. This is an image which Corbusier developed and used for many of his subsequent office buildings projects. Here we see on top an image brought back by José Luis Sert to Paris in 1934 from Moscow, and we see the building in not yet completed. And at the bottom, a sketch, one of the many sketches sent to Korb from Moscow, by Charlotte Perriand, discussing the changes and in the quality of glass in respect to the original project on the facade, the use of different types of glass plates. In fact, Charlotte, and this is really a very interesting material, this is one of the color samples which were brought back by Charlotte Perriand from Moscow, now at the Fondation Le Corbusier in Paris. These samples prompted an angry reaction of Le Corbusier, who affirmed, I quote, "The colors are those of the boudoir. This is by no means a Soviet polychromy." In fact, more substantial changes took place in the construction of the facade, as we've seen before, and with the use of metallic frames for the double glazing, which were thicker than the slender one, perhaps incautiously drafted in Paris. And here we see another remarkable sketch of Perriand showing all the little changes, documenting everything that has happened on the site, also at the Fondation. So we have really the possibility of understanding the way in which the initial project was adapted. So this is really significant. There were other little changes which are rather funny in a way. The back of the building, the piloti, pure cylinders, were fluted, this manner of what I call colonization, giving them the dignity simple stilts would never have acquired in the times of socialist realism. This architectural, quote, and improvement, end quote, also extended to the interior, and here we have not a very good documentation of the interior, unfortunately, where industrial finishes imagined by Le Corbusier were dropped in favor of more elaborate materials. The posts in the Great Hall, and maybe I'll just, yes, we see it here, we see them here. The posts in the Great Hall were faced with reconstituted grey marble with pale oak mouldings in lieu of the missing capitals and four black marble plinths. The walls were faced in yellow Crimean marble and the floors composed of large squares of light grey marble with a crisscross pattern of darker grey lines. The lamps in were carpeted. We'll see them later. The lamps were carpeted in black rubber and paneled with oak. The walls of the landings were of grey marble. The office partitions were also decorated in various pale-colored woods. And I send you back to the color samples. In short, the completed object was totally faithful to the composition and the structural principles of Le Corbusier, but had been significantly resurfaced internally by Colli. The building was hotly debated in the press. Viktor Kokorin, Moscow architect, qualified this Chuzhoy Dom, foreign house, as unholy. The former constructivist and later Neutra partner Sergei Kozhin regretted the cold, monotonous, disagreeable nature of the walls behind which, he wrote, people must work under tension like automata without joy, end quote. This photo, by the way, is by Rodchenkov, 1935. Alone, Alexander Vesnin praised bravely Moscow's best building in the last 100 years, one, he wrote, characterized by clarity of architectural thought, precision in the construction of masses and volumes, the purity of different elements reflecting contrast and nuances, overall scale and attention to detail, a lightness associated with monumentality, simplicity, and architectural unity. In a heated, this is a photo of the 1930s, right after completion, in a heated meeting between the architects and party leader, Lazar Kaganovich, mentioned him yesterday, Stalin's deputy simply declared the building to be, quote, a big pink sow with legs too short, end quote. And Colli had himself to take a safe distance at the tribune of the 1937 Architects Congress. Having survived the war's bombs unheard, the building was not spared the attacks of the architectural apparatchiki in the years of Zhdanovism. It was still vehemently condemned in the early 1950s. The building, however, would be rehabilitated, at least symbolically, culturally, together with architectural modernism under Khrushchev, as it was transferred to the central direction of statistics of the USSR. It is featured, for instance, here in 1962 in Bulinkin's handbook, The History of Soviet Architecture, where it is seen, I quote, as an example of the most acute expression of Western constructivism. We know that Korb always said he was not a constructivist. But anyway, the building's plan, writes Bulinkin, the building's plan layout fits fully with the content and the character of a Soviet institution, end quote, even if some rooms are underlit and others receive excessive summer light. The reason of the shortcomings of buildings for Bulinkin is what he calls the canonization of some formal principles. In short, it is too Corbusian, but it is expressive on the Kirov side, the Kirov Street. Kirov Street side, the Kirov Street replaced the Myasnitskaya in the toponymy of Moscow at that time, in the 30s. What Bulinkin also says is, and it's important in the history of building, additions to the ground floor have partially destroyed the architect's concept. Additions were, in fact, the creation of continuous spaces under the piloti, completely destroying the transparency of the building. It is true that this space had been completely enclosed in order to extend the office space. Colley supervised before his death some restoration work on the facade in the 60s before a complete overhaul of the glass walls was undertaken in the 70s under the direction of Leonid Pavlov, a former student of Leonidov, probably the most Mission of the Soviet architects active from the 60s through the 80s. Pavlov also built an elegant office building in the back. Aluminum profiles were used in a restrained manner for these works, and this is a photo I did there a very long time ago in the late 70s of the building at that time. Now occupied by the Federal Service of Statistics of the Federation of Russia, the building is listed as a historic monument at the federal level. So here we have one of the few buildings in the, probably the only one in Moscow. It's said. It's written on the building. So the plaque is a lie. Yeah? Okay, anyway, discussion. We all wish it were federal. Maybe it's not. Anyway, it's listed. One plaque and a sculptural composition featuring a reproduction of a modular on the right vouch for this status of a building. This status should, in theory, give to the building the eligibility of being restored if it were a federal building. It is interesting that people using the building today are relatively skeptical about it. The Fondation Le Corbusier last year gave me a message from the person in charge of the documentation at the building asking, is it true that the building is by the architect Le Corbusier? So people using the building don't even trust what is hanging there. Indeed, a complete overhaul of the structure is necessary to return it to a state of historical consistency. The task is not impossible, given the apparently sound condition of the building's structural elements, such as the concrete skeleton, the ramps, here seen in a remarkable photo by Richard, already seen, and the roof. The exact condition of the offices is difficult, and here we see the stairs, which are really in great shape, except for lighting features. The exact condition of the offices is difficult to attest, as a visit to the interior of a building is always very difficult. Statistics seem to remain as secret in Putin's Russia as they were in Soviet times. But a series of problems can be easily listed. On the base of frequent surveys of the exterior done by me and a visit made in last year, without, however, the permission to make photographs. On the exterior, the surroundings are poorly managed. The space under the building remains enclosed and the pilotis are unperceivable. The integrity of the stone cladding has been compromised by the bad condition of the joints and the irrelevant cement repairs. The lighting of the outdoor space is achieved with unfit fixtures. The aluminum frames have aged and sometimes are deformed. Occasionally, clear glass panes have been replaced by colored ones or by an improper one. The inadequateness of the heating and ventilation system is revealed in the punctual presence of external air conditioners on the left, installed in an ad hoc manner, and in the creation of protruding mechanical ventilation ducts, as you see here, on the site of the Myasnitskaya Street. As perceived from the outside, substantial transformations have been brought to the offices. We see here, we can realize how many partitions have been added to the interior spaces now. The interior facade has been reshaped to create conventional windows, and new partitions have been introduced to accommodate daily activities. Of course, the issue here would not be necessary to return to a complete, authentic organization of the office space reflecting Le Corbusier's unimplemented ideas, but simply to respect the architectonic properties of the building. Or, and this is another question, are we thinking in the manner of Viollet-le-Duc to restore the building in as it should have been built, according to his words? A brief visit of the interior spaces reveals the poor condition of large part of the floors, where the original white and grey marble installed by Colley has been replaced by ordinary tiles. a large part of the ground floor's pavement has been damaged by the underground works related with the creation of a new subway line, but damage seems at first sight to be limited to the superficial layers of the pavement and floor. The original rubber flooring is in most cases missing from the ramps, see on the left. The original Paternoster chain elevators on the right, both photo by Richard, these Paternoster chain continuous elevators, once a feature in all office buildings in Germany and Russia, are unusable today, but could easily be restored. Many such systems are still working in Germany, and I recently saw a magnificent one in a Behrens building in Berlin-Köpenick. The lighting used throughout the circulation spaces of the building is based on neon tubes, which are dysfunctional, anachronistic, and simply irrelevant here. If the office floors lit by the glass wall are bathed in a sometimes excessive sunlight, most circulations have a rather gloomy atmosphere. The issue of color, of course, cannot be dismissed. The present grayish tone of the walls, of most of the walls, doesn't correspond either to the colors prescribed by Le Corbusier or to the color scheme proposed by Colley, which can be found and documented very well, as you've seen. Russia, and this is my conclusion, I've tried to keep it short, Russia hasn't joined the preparation of a collective bid made in 2005-2006 by five countries following an initiative of the Le Corbusier Foundation to have a cluster of buildings by the architect proposed for UNESCO's heritage list. So five countries were active in the proposal. The Swiss, top left, we see the splendid Jeanne Repéret house recently remarkably restored in La Chaux-de-Fonds. Top right, Ronchamp, which is in great danger, not the building itself, the site, because of a very, very, disputable addition presently designed by Renzo Piano, by a very good architect, to house a monastery on the chapel's grounds. So really here, just underneath the church, there might be a real risk. The Guillette house in Anvers, in Antwerp, was very well restored, as well as the house in Stuttgart. And the fifth country participating to the project is Argentina with the Kurichet house. The Russian Committee for UNESCO seems supportive of the idea of putting Korb on the list. So the question is whether we'll have Centro Soyuz in the bid, and maybe the Centro Soyuz will in the end be included in a list of emblematic buildings to be protected and restored. Despite the apparent solidity of its main structure, it's a very, very sturdy object. It is clear, however, that the restoration of many of its architectural features is a considerable project given its bulk, which will require direct investment by Russia's federal government. In short, it is another test, one of many, of the willingness of a country's leadership to protect its modern heritage. The quality of the built space, the cultural and architectural meaning of the building, as documented by Richard's interior photographs, is, I think, an excellent incentive for rapid action. Thank you.